WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill. It's our summer fun drive. Donate at WJFFradio.org.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. Manor Inc. is the youth-driven, community-supported monthly newspaper published by the Livingston Manor Free Library. And today, we will be bringing you some of our stories. On today's show, The Ink sits down with New York Senator Mike Martucci. The first-term politician tells us about his priorities and what it's like to be a Republican in a Democrat-controlled Senate and government. Jacob Pasquale has the story of honor flights resuming to fly local veterans to D.C. Plus, my review of the animated film Luca. And my letter from the editor. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Fire crews in Northern California are struggling to contain the Dixie Fire, now the third largest wildfire in state history. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports weather conditions this weekend are expected to both help and hinder the firefighting effort.
The good news is the strong winds that helped the Dixie Fire grow by more than 100,000 acres Thursday and Friday have died down, and relative humidity has gone up. Both of those weather changes this weekend are expected to help put the brakes on the fire's explosive growth. But the wind change is also trapping more smoke over the fire area and surrounding cities, which could severely limit the ability of firefighting aircraft to attack the blaze. It could also make work for ground crews even harder. While no serious injuries or deaths have been reported, the fire has torched dozens of homes and destroyed the mountain town of Greenville. Eric Westervelt, NPR News.
Wildfires made worse by climate change are also raging in Turkey and Greece, where flames have swept through a suburb of Athens. On Capitol Hill, senators are preparing to try to advance that bipartisan infrastructure bill that's a top priority for President Biden. In about an hour, they will convene for the second weekend in a row. The U.S. is now averaging more than 100,000 COVID-19 infections a day. That's according to Johns Hopkins University, putting the country on par with the caseload back in November. NPR's Amy Held reports the Delta variant is driving up hospitalizations and deaths.
The country's seven-day average for new infections is up about tenfold from just a month ago, and hundreds of people are dying each day from COVID-19. This surge is still below January's, when new cases peaked around 250,000 a day, but officials warn the U.S. will get back there if more people don't get vaccinated. In Alabama, just around a third of residents are fully vaccinated, and ERs are once again overwhelmed, except now the patients are younger and sicker. Dr. Kirsten Kennedy is chief of hospital medicine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham Hospital.
You're just worn out. You know, we've been doing this for a year and a half.
Alabama's vaccination rate has shot up, more than doubling in recent weeks. Amy Held, NPR News.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson at the center of another coronavirus controversy, as Vicky Barker reports from London.
When a member of Boris Johnson's team tested positive for the coronavirus during his recent tour of Scotland, aides said the Prime Minister never had close contact with the person, so did not need to quarantine. It's now being reported the two were actually side by side on several occasions. No comment from Johnson's aides yet.
Allyson Felix, now the most decorated American track star in Olympic history. She surpassed Carl Lewis today, winning her 11th medal of gold as part of the 4x400-meter relay team. This is NPR News.
Hi, my name is Hiba Ahmed, and I am a producer with NPR's Weekend Edition. We like to say that nothing goes uncovered at Weekend Edition. We're trying to find the best person to possibly have the conversation with. And that might be an expert, or maybe it's somebody who's really at the heart of the story. Though you may only hear the voices of the hosts and the reporters, there's actually a ton of people behind the scenes who make every single segment come to life, whether that's a producer, an editor, an engineer, a fact checker. We all have the same mission in mind. We want to bring you the best journalism possible. I'm Hiba Ahmed. When you donate to the station, you support all the work that goes into bringing you the kind of journalism you expect from public radio. Here's how to give.
Make a donation of any amount at WJFFradio.org or call 845-482-4141.
NPR News is trustworthy and dependable. You rely on this member station to stay informed every day, come what may. We are here for you. Thanks to your support.
WJFF Radio Catskill is here every day, offering the very best of public radio to your friends, neighbors, and you. Support the news and information you rely on. Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill. Listen to us on your smart speaker. Just ask your smart speaker to play WJFF Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting an equitable recovery and the reinvention of systems to create a more just, inclusive, and resilient world. More information is at macfound.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Mandarin. New York State Senator Mike Martucci represents the 42nd New York State Senate District, which includes Sullivan County. The senator is in his first term, having defeated incumbent Democrat Jen Metzger last November in a close and hotly contested race. My Mandarin colleague Olivia Williams and I sat down with the senator recently, and here's what he told us.
So, just to start off, what exactly does a state senator do?
So, it's a great question. And I would tell you many, many adults, by the way, don't know what state senate is or what it does, because when people meet me, they think I work in Washington, right? And we don't. Yeah. Just like you typically see on TV where there's a U.S. Senate and a House of Representatives, which represents an upper and lower legislative body in Washington, D.C., that same thing exists here in the state of New York. So there are 63 state senators. Each of us represent a district of about 300,000 people. So it's based on population. In our body of 63, we make up what's considered the upper house, or the state senate portion of the state legislature. There's also a lower house, which is the state assembly. That's made up of 150 members. Assemblywoman Gunther, whose thing is hanging right there on the wall, it has represented this area for many, many years in the state assembly. So basically, a state senator is a member of the upper house of the state legislature, and we don't work with the president of the United States, we work with the governor. So just like a U.S. senator would work with the executive of the country who's the president, we work with the executive of the state who's the governor. Essentially, what are our jobs? So there's kind of like two parts of the job, if you can imagine it. There's what we do in Albany, which is the capital, and then there's what we do here in the district at home. So, and they're very different, actually. So sort of at the capital, we do legislation, working together to collaboratively write laws and pass laws that affect so many different parts of our life, whether it's education, healthcare, local government, local services, all sorts of things legislatively. The other big job that we do in Albany is the state budget, which is sort of like our biggest responsibility each year. It's about a $200 billion spending plan that we negotiate together along with the governor, obviously. And then, so that's sort of like the Albany activity of what we do. And then home in the district here, a lot of it is what we call constituent services. So a lot of what we do here has to do with helping people get connected with services they need. People call us for all sorts of things. It could be things like unemployment. They have problems with their unemployment benefits. They could be having problems finding housing, health care. They could be having issues locally, perhaps with local government. So a lot of what we're doing here at home is helping people with, again, what we call like local or district-based issues. So those are sort of like the two prongs of the job. There's one legislative prong, and then there's also what you call district-based, or sort of what you're doing at home. You know, when people say to me, what is your responsibility here at home? It's sort of everything, right? I mean, we get things from issues like that, small business issues, people that have issues with their neighbors, zoning problems. I mean, you name it, right? There's almost nothing that sort of doesn't fall under the umbrella of where we can help. And if it does come to us, and it's not necessarily something that we deal with. So I'll give you an example. We have somebody that called us that has an issue, a federal issue, having to do with their passport. They want to go on vacation. They can't get their passport done in time. We work collaboratively with our congressional member here, that's Congressman Delgado, and we'll connect them with resources from his office to help with the federal issue, and then he'll do the same vice versa. If it's a state issue, it'll come to us. So a lot of what we do is working with one another, interconnected to solve problems for people that live here.
So what are your current, like, priorities like? Like, specifically in Sullivan County, like, what are you trying to do? Like,
yeah, so Sullivan County, obviously, there are a few, some that have been here for a long time, and I think that some that represent some real potential for our future. You know, the first is certainly broadband is always a conversation in this county. It has been for such a long time. And, you know, the state really has not made, from my perspective, significant advancements in expanding broadband. And I think that, you know, what you've seen this year with the virus has only magnified the importance of that, right? So many folks are now working from home. So many people are studying from home. I think we look forward to next year really being back in school. But look, at the drop of a hat, we could be back doing all this from home again. So I think it's clear that we need to make some significant advancements. A couple of things that I'm working on. One of them, and some of these are like a little bit in the weeds because sort of like these issues are a bit technical, but one of them has to do with repealing a tax that currently exists on state right-of-ways. So very simply, if a broadband company wants to run broadband to a location that currently doesn't have it, anywhere there's a state highway, and there's many of them, State Route 42, 52, mm-hmm. tons of them. There's currently right-of-way taxes that apply, right? So that these companies have to pay fees to run their fiber or cable in these right-of-way areas. So obviously that's a pretty large cost that eventually gets pushed on to ratepayers, or in some cases just prevents companies from coming in and providing this service altogether. And the reason the companies don't provide these services in some rural areas is because if the four of you live down a street, say you live down a street and there's four houses in 2 miles, right? It might cost the company millions of dollars to run infrastructure down that street, and they only get four ratepayers out of the deal. You know what I mean? So the economics of it don't work. So one of the things that we have to be focused on is incentivizing companies to go into places down these rural areas, places that they currently are not. So that's one measure that I've been working on. The second is in cooperation with the county. There's a plan at looking at wireless internet service. I'm sure you've read about it and reported on it.
We wrote a bit.
You wrote about it. Perfect. So Congressman Delgado, federal funds make up a great majority of the funding source, but Assemblywoman Gunther and I, who work very well together, are also focused on that project as well, because I think the solution to this is really comes in a couple of different buckets, right? There's no really one answer to filling the gaps that exist. Lastly and finally, in this year's state budget, we passed at long last a broadband mapping bill. And essentially what this bill does is this. Currently, the government, to determine who has broadband and who doesn't, uses what's called census blocks, which are blocks or groups of homes where people live. So say again, for an example, we all live in the same area, the same census block. If I have internet service because I live right next to the state road, but the four of you don't because you're down a back street, unfortunately, what the data shows is that all of us have internet service, which isn't true, right? So what this mapping bill is going to do is the mapping bill is going to show us particularly the places, really right down to a street level and an individual home level, who has internet service and who doesn't. So I think what's really kind of the takeaway point from this is understanding those places that aren't mapped yet. Because a lot of times you'll hear the governor's office or others say, well, 90% of New Yorkers or 95% of New Yorkers have internet service. And what they're talking about is they're talking about per census block. And what we know is that when you get down on a more granular level, the numbers aren't that good, right? There are far more people that don't have it. And one of my big concerns, truthfully, is there will be a growing disparity between people who have and people who do not. And what I mean that is, you know, there's a lot of people moving up from the metropolitan area in New York City, working from home here, and what you're starting to see is a greater divide between people that have access to high-speed internet and people who don't. And there will be a true cliff that emerges. It already is emerging, but it will even more clearly emerge as we move forward. And we're talking about educational disparity, income disparity, all sorts of things that are going to be right focused around internet. So that's one of them. The other thing I want to be laser-focused on is build out of our trail system in this county. The county legislature is focused on this right now. I think tourism is the future of this county in so many ways, right? When you look at the history of this county, the last time it was really booming, it was a tourism county. Agriculture will be a component of this county, but clearly will not be the economic driver of this county, right? So we have to be focused on tourism. We have an outstanding trail system that we can build out if we have the resources to do it. So that's another focus.
So what's it like to be a Republican, Democratic-controlled Senate and government?
It's a good question, right? So What's it like to be in a minority? Here's what I would tell you. It's all about working together. And what I'm going to tell you is there is a collegiality, a professionalism that exists in the state legislature that I sincerely appreciate. And when I mean that, here's what I mean. I sit around a table like this with Democrats who agree with me on some issues and not on others, but we're able to, as a legislature, engage in, you know, meaningful conversations, meaningful debate. And while being in the minority, what it generally means for me is I don't get everything I want. What we certainly can always do is make sure that our voices are heard on key issues. So I can think of several examples of that this year where, you know, there were issues that were being debated. And while maybe I didn't support the whole issue, I would come to the table with an amendment or an idea or an important modification that was considered and included. So, you know, I think that really what it comes down to, when you look at a legislative body, it functions a lot different than an executive, right? So when you're the president or the governor, unilaterally, you have a whole lot of power. When you're in a legislature, from a governing standpoint, I can't do anything without 31 other people agreeing with me, right? Understand that. If I just say I want to work as an island to do my own thing, you will get nothing done, right? So what's so important is that you have the ability to build consensus, you have the ability to work across the aisle, and even with members of your own party, and you have the ability to compromise. So for me, I think that, you know, what I would characterize this first year being a lot about was being focused more on finding the common ground that we can find, because there's a lot of it, right? And also understanding that when we come to the table, I'm working with members like her old boss, who are New York City members, who have a totally different set of priorities than we have here, who have a different set of priorities than people from Western New York. So I guess the short answer to the long answer I just gave you was, it's all about working together. You absolutely have to do it. Because if I'm unwilling to do that, I will be tremendously ineffective.
Yeah.
And I think really any legislator would be tremendously ineffective, because we're not executives. You know, there's nothing we can do unilaterally, you know, that makes any difference. So we absolutely have to work together. And everybody's been willing to do that, frankly, even when we disagree. And when we disagree, it's okay. We get up to the table, we shake hands, and we say we disagree. And, you know, that's the way the process works. The majority rules in any legislature. So, you know, there are certainly times, and there were certainly issues this year that we voted on that I left unhappy about or feeling like things went the wrong way. But understanding that's our process, you know, and you go back to the table the next day, starting again on a new issue from a new starting point. And, you know, it's the process. And I think that it's important that anybody who's elected is able to put aside the politics of things and really look at the policy, because that's what drives our lives, you know? I think one example I'll just draw is, because you're thinking like, oh, I'm talking a little abstractly. Take, for example, our school funding model, right? There's a great example. So the way that schools are funded in this state are very different based on where you live. The city has its own sort of like way that it funds schools, and then rural schools are funded in a different way than suburban schools are funded. So that was a huge debate this year, as is a debate every year, where we talk about rural school funding and the school funding models. And without getting too far into the weeds, you know, something that we call foundation aid formula and how it affects rural school districts. So that was just one example where, you know, most of the Democrats in the majority represent more urban areas than I represent as a general rule. They were absolutely willing to be open to our thoughts and ideas on school funding models, and our rural schools did very well this year, I think, because of that collaborative approach. Some very convoluted formulas, right, that essentially drive a school funding model. And if you can imagine school funding, it's sort of really in two big buckets, and then sort of like two big buckets and one smaller one. But the two big buckets are here, property tax and state aid. So the more we can bring in state aid, the more it allows a local school board to reduce property taxes, which is the biggest tax that your parents and your neighbors and the people that live here pay by a long shot. So my job basically is to bring resources into the school, and then the school board, which is another elected body, gets to make decisions about what they do, right? Maybe they reduce taxes, maybe they hire more teachers, maybe they bring in a new program. Whatever they do, that sort of decision is made at the local level. My job, you know, my part in the bigger puzzle really is bringing the resources, the most resources we can in to help them in that effort.
So to you, what are Sullivan County's biggest needs?
So I think we talked about the broadband, right? I mean, clearly, I think that there's a disparity that's emerging clearer and clearer as we march forward every single day. Certainly, the other piece that I look at Sullivan County, and I think is really important, is skilled workforce development. When I say that, what I mean is, here, young people like you graduate high school, right? There's sort of two choices. You can go to college, right? Which in most cases means leaving this county, going somewhere else, right? And unfortunately, oftentimes not coming back, right? We see that a lot of young people that leave this county go to school and then don't return to this area. Which, to me, I look at that and say, boy, what are some things that we could do to either help return or attract people back here after they leave for college, or those young people that leave high school that aren't college bound, sort of like what happens to them, right? If they go right into work after high school, what we all know is you can't afford to live anywhere but your parents' house, right? It really is not a good option for you, right? The income opportunities are very limited. So one of the things that I think would be a huge opportunity for the county would be to look at what I call skilled workforce development. Now, these sorts of opportunities exist in other places. A lot of times, what I'm talking about are union jobs, becoming like union carpenters, union electricians, maybe leaving high school and going into a trade program where you can become a radiology technician and get a job at the hospital, or other sorts of trades like that. And those sorts of things, opportunities really don't exist locally here. You have to drive quite a long distance. So I think that there are clear opportunities, whether it's working with a community college or with BOCES or other organizations here, to create some of those opportunities so that a young person can leave high school, maybe go to a trade school for 18 months or 2 years and leave and be able to earn a wage that allows them to buy a home in this county, live in this county, stay in this county. So I think workforce development is a huge opportunity for us in the future here. Plus the other piece is, anyone who knows, I'm sure you've tried to hire someone at your house, an electrician or a carpenter, you can't find these people, right? The unfortunate part is, you have to wait a long time for one of these folks to come. We talk about the importance in this county. I talked about some of the other technical skills, things like dental hygiene, radiology tech, dialysis technicians, right? Those are all services that this county can use more of. We just don't have a workforce to support it. So I think workforce development is a huge opportunity as well.
What are like the biggest concerns that you tend to hear from voters?
So around here, I think you always get the expensive to live in New York concern, right? The cost of living here. So as you know, we live very close to Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and just some other states that border right here. We talked about property taxes, and certainly in a place like Pennsylvania, property taxes look a whole lot different than they do here in New York. So we hear from a lot of seniors in particular who say, I'm leaving here because it's so expensive to live here. So certainly the property tax conversation is one that is always coming up in terms of cost of living. That's probably, if I had to paint with a broad brush, that's probably like the number one. As of immediate too, the other thing I would call out is obviously the virus, right? I mean, sort of since I've been in office, right, what has consumed our entire focus and really will be a large part of our focus for a long time moving forward is, not only, managing the pandemic, which started before my time, right when I got in office in January, we were focused on bringing in as many vaccines as we could, establishing vaccine clinics, helping people get signed up for that process. Which was rocky at first, but really leveled out in a pretty good way. Today, our focus remains on educating folks, helping people get vaccines who haven't gotten them yet, though those numbers continue to fall, helping our businesses reopen, helping our schools safely reopen. So I think the other thing that we hear about, which hopefully we won't hear about in another year from now, but really is sort of right at the forefront of every conversation is just things having to do with COVID, emerging from COVID, how do we do it safely, how do we do it smart, That sort of whole umbrella of things, which really I could talk about for a day and a half. So I would say number one, probably since I've been here, is COVID, and then number two sort of has to do with that broader conversation of, So I also represent Orange County, part of Orange County. And yet, the health disparities are really clear. When you look at, Orange County as a health department, it was able to mobilize 30 or 40 people to execute clinics and all sorts of things that this county just simply didn't have in terms of resources. So I think it does paint a broader picture. And you know what? COVID really, again, I always use the word magnified a lot of these disparities, things that were there that maybe folks didn't see or didn't understand in a really clear way. But now I think more so than ever, has made so clear that we need to address. Yeah, and I mean, there's a coalition of folks that are working, you know, obviously on this broader issue. And, you know, for us, it's really just, you know, finding our piece in that coalition and doing what we can to push and add to it. And one of the challenges, frankly, is say you graduate high school and you say, I want to go into nursing. Great, right? So you leave here, you go to college, say in Westchester County or Rockland County or somewhere else, right? Maybe not even that far from here, an hour and a half, 2 hours from here. And you graduate, right? And the problem is now you're living in Tarrytown and you open the newspaper and there's a job at the hospital in Yonkers. And you say, boy, you know, this pays pretty good. I'm here already. I kind of like this area. And that's what happens for a lot of young people is they don't come back home here. So I think that the opportunity to create some of those programs right here in the county will allow us to offer that to young people in a way that they can perhaps live at home, save some money, do these programs, and then obtain employment right here in the county, because you're absolutely right. That's the number one issue we hear from employers is we can't find skilled workforce. We can't, the people don't exist. They're not here. You know what I mean?
I was doing some research on you earlier. And,
I love it. See, he's good. You're a good reporter.
Yeah. First time doing any actually
good
reporting. I was looking at an article about something about your school bus company. Some of the parts of the school buses weren't functioning so great and were shoddily maintained.
Yeah, so quickly about my history. So I owned a school bus company that I started when I was 22. So I graduated college with an MBA in 2008, which, to rewind, 2008 was a really bad time to graduate college. Not a lot of jobs, tremendous economic instability, really bad job. 2008 was not a good year to be looking for a job, right? You remember 2008. Financial crisis, really bad news. So when I graduated school, I did something pretty crazy. I bought one school bus and I started driving it on a contract in Orange County, transporting displaced youth, so homeless youth. So basically, if you're a youth and you have a problem with your family and for whatever reason you can't stay in your home, oftentimes Department of Social Service will place you in another home, sometimes even a hotel, sadly, temporarily, until they kind of sort out your situation. So what happens is when you're a displaced youth, you might say go to Livingston Manor High School here, but you get placed in Monticello. Well, one of the big important things that we must do is maintain some stability in your life. And one of that means that you got to come to school over here where you normally go to school, right? You want to change your school on a temporary basis. So the job that I had was transporting youth who lived outside of their school district to their home district. So I'm giving you the kind of frame of reference of my bus company first. So I began doing that. My grandma, who was retired at the time, came and was my very first bus driver. I couldn't even afford to pay anybody. So my grandmother worked for me. And it was really a volunteer. So I started the company with two buses. Over 10 years, I grew the company to just shy of 600 employees. So it was one of the 50 largest privately held school transportation companies in the country. North America is the only place on the planet that has school buses, believe it or not, that bring children to and from school. In Europe, they use all public transportation. You go to other places like China or like Japan, public transportation is what young people use to get to and from school, or they walk. So here, we're the only, United States and Canada are the only countries that, through a public funding system, actually have a student transportation system. Some other countries do it kind of in a more disparate way with private money and things. So it's interesting that a UK company identified that as a transportation opportunity to come here. But anyway, so long story short, I sold the company in April of 2018. So that's sort of like professionally what I did. I was on the entrepreneurial side of things, having started and grew a business. So look, in the campaign, certainly what had happened was my opponent and political people who run political campaigns do a tremendous amount of research on you as a candidate and will actively work, you know, to do things to create doubt in the minds of voters and things. So one of those things was through a public process of looking up accidents that my company had. And my company is rated by several government entities. One of them is the Department of Transportation, DOT. They regulate school bus safety. And for all 10 years that I owned the company, we had the highest school bus safety ratings. I was also the president of the School Bus Operators Association for 2 years during my time. But unfortunately, accidents do happen, right? I mean, when you operate hundreds and hundreds of buses and travel millions of miles a year. Yeah. So what had happened in that campaign was my opponent had seized on to one particular accident that had occurred and really made that the focal point of the campaign. And
I think I know the accident you're talking about. Was that the one? It was the only one that they were really specific about, where one of your employees who was under an illegal substance ran into a motorcyclist.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. With a child inside the vehicle.
That's correct. Yep. So what I would tell you is, you know, for whatever reason, in a state Senate campaign, that really became the thrust and focus of what my opponent was talking about with me. And I think that, for me, I think the voters are more focused on other issues that really matter a whole lot to them. But yeah, that was obviously a very unfortunate accident that had occurred. And, subsequent to that accident, the great news is, it's ironic in that things like that sort of put me in this seat. I had become the president of the School Bus Operators Association shortly after that accident. And I had advocated in Albany to pass a set of laws. Specifically, one of them has to do with the drug testing of school bus drivers. So I'll bring it deep into this a little bit. This is crazy. Prior to 2016 or 17, don't quote me exactly, I can find this and get it to you. Prior to 2016 or 17, there was no state law that required school bus drivers be drug tested. It was a federal law, and what the federal law was it fell under what was called Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. So there's the feds that manage traffic safety. Specifically, the feds manage traffic safety with respect to commercial vehicles. And the reason is there's commercial vehicles do a lot of what's called interstate travel, right? So a tractor trailer drives from California to New York, and it travels through many states. So the feds get involved with commercial vehicles specifically because commercial vehicles transverse multiple states' jurisdictions. So in the federal law, what it required was individuals that drive vehicles over 18,000 pounds. So it designated those vehicles by gross vehicle weight, GVW, were required to be drug tested. Well, many school buses have gross vehicle weights under 18,000 pounds. And for that reason, no drug testing was required. This is why, by the way, your parents can go buy one of those 40-foot motorhomes, or your grandpa can drive a 40-foot motorhome and just drive it down the road with no special license, right? Because it goes by, ironically, vehicle weight. You probably wondered that. Like, well, how can somebody with a regular car license drive this big thing? Well, it all has to do with the weight of the vehicle, not the length or the size. So long story short, one of the huge efforts that I had undertaken after that accident was to change the law that required all school bus drivers, regardless of the weight of the vehicle they were driving, to be drug tested. And that's now in state statute. And was something that had emerged from that accident as an important issue, because employers prior to that didn't have a law by which they could test all school bus drivers. Ironically, they could only test a school bus driver who was operating a vehicle over a certain GVW. So very technical, in the weeds. It's an example of a chapter, or what we call a chapter in a law that frankly hadn't been looked at for a very long time. Nobody probably had known a lot about it. Was really a technical change to a law that I think really just made the spirit of the law match the
intent,
the original legislative intent that was sort of like carved out in the beginning for, just the language of the language of the piece itself. Yes, it's sort of interesting, right? So that, by the way, was my foray into government, because I had never served in government ever before this. I had never been elected the dog catcher, the town councilman, nothing. So. That was sort of where I became aware of or engaged in, interaction with state government. Yeah, so.
Interesting.
Interesting, right? So that's where I got my flavor of it, and here I am, Okay. Anything else?
Do you have anything else for me?
Okay. All right. Well, look. You guys know how to get in contact with me via, I didn't bring a car and I walked down the street. You have my info. Yeah. If there's anything you want, follow up, email questions, you want to get on the phone with me, please reach out to me because I'm always available to you. And thank you for what you do. It's so awesome to see young people doing this.
You're listening to Radio Chatsville Teen Edition. I'm Elsie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. Honor Flight is an organization that flies veterans from around the country to Washington, D.C. to see the monuments and memorials of the wars they fought in. The organization has hubs all over the country, and the local one is the Hudson Valley Honor Flight. However, this year, they will be doing things a little differently. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, they have had to put their flights on hold. This fall, they are returning with a flight on October 9th, leaving from Stewart International Airport. Here's Mannering's Jacob Pasquale with more.
The first question I want to ask is, how did you find out about Honor Flight, and how did you decide to get involved with it?
Oh, how I got involved. I had heard about Hudson Valley Honor Flight probably back in 2014, and I ended up signing up to go as a guardian and went in September of 2014 with a World War II veteran. And the next month, October of 2014, they were doing their first flight out of Westchester County Airport. So the executive director at the time reached out to me to ask me if I would join them as part of their safety team because of my background as an emergency room nurse. So I did that, and then the following year, so actually probably like 2 months later, they approached me to become the safety coordinator. So I was the safety coordinator for the Westchester County flights for a couple of years. And that's how I got involved. And I will tell you, from the first flight, it's just been absolutely incredible.
I know since you can't do the flights now, you decided to...
Yeah, so what we decided to do, since our flights have essentially been grounded because of COVID, was we tried to come up with a way to honor our veterans that are on our wait list. And the way we did that was with lawn signs. It was a pretty big undertaking. We had 675 veterans on our wait list. We had a group of volunteers calling all of the veterans, explaining to them what the program was, asking them if they would like to participate. And then the second part of that was getting the help and with the volunteers to get the signs delivered. I will tell you that the program has been very well received. The veterans are just thrilled. It was great to be out there in the community again and doing something for our veterans. So we want, you know, that was what we came up with, to do something safe while we are waiting to return to flight.
Mm-hmm. When is the next honor flight?
So we will be flying again this fall. We have a flight on October 9th out of Stewart International Airport, and we have a flight November 6th out of Westchester County Airport.
Okay, and how many veterans are going to be on upcoming flights?
So we just actually started the process this week. On average, the flights out of Stewart Airport, we will take anywhere from 82 to 84 veterans. And the flights out of Westchester County Airport, usually around 70, give or take.
And who is eligible to attend an honor flight?
So the veterans that are eligible for a honor flight are, we are still currently have World War II veterans and Korean War veterans on our list, so they get top priority, just being that they're the older generations.
Mm-hmm.
So currently we are taking World War II, Korean War veterans, what we call Cold War veterans, which those veterans served between the time of the Korean War and the time that Vietnam started. And we do have some of our Vietnam wait list, that will be going this fall. And we also take any terminally ill veteran from any time of service.
Oh. And is it going to be mandatory for the veterans to have taken the COVID-19 vaccine?
Okay, so to answer your question, yes. We are going to require that all participants are vaccinated. So for safety purposes, Hudson Valley Honor Flight is following the guidance from the National Honor Flight Network that's going to require all flight participants to be vaccinated for this fall. I will tell you, we have over 550 Vietnam applications on file. So these two, the these first two flights that we're getting out, obviously the veterans that were slotted to go last spring,
right,
they're getting to go first.
Okay.
So that's just how we're doing it fairly. And we have gotten a handful of, I just got another World War II application last week.
Wow.
I got a Korean War application yesterday. So they're still coming in. There's still quite a lot on our wait list, which is why we're so excited to get back. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the amount of times I have heard from them. This was one of the best days of my life. That, you know, that's huge. You know, aside from maybe getting married and having children,
yeah,
their honor flight day is just one of the best.
You're listening to Radio Chatsko, Teen Edition. I'm Leslie Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Mandarin Inc., and here's my review of the film Luca. There are like two types of movies and TV shows I consume. Fighting and often awful teen dramas. They even overlap sometimes. I rarely stray away from this formula when watching TV shows and movies, but many have told me about this new Disney Pixar movie that was supposedly really good, so I took a step out of my usual zone and decided to watch it. So this is my review of Disney Pixar's Luca. Luca is a coming-of-age story about a young sea monster who wants to explore the human world with his new friend. When he exits the water, he takes on a human form, but whenever the water touches him, his true form starts to show through. This, along with the setting, a fishing town where locals are in fear of sea monsters, sets up a lot of the tension in the movie, as the characters navigate the town trying not to get outed and subsequently killed. A lot of what I liked about this movie were the character interactions. The way the friendships built and evolved, the issues that arose, and the handling of said issues felt very natural and real, given how unreal the situation was. I'm not going to go into spoiler territory, but so many of the characters had such good arcs and dynamic growth. I also have to say that the animation was really nice. Same with the character designs. They were also expressive and descriptive. You could tell almost everything about the characters based on how they looked. The overall design of the backgrounds and scenery brought the movie together. I think people overlook how a really solid environment pulls the movie together. The vibrant color palette, the chips in the paint of wood, the varying rock sizes and shapes in the cobblestone. It really tugs the audience into the film when the design of the background is so detailed and expansive. If I had to give Luca a single negative, it would be its predictability. I know that it's a kids movie and all, but before you even get halfway through the film, you can already lay out the general sequence of events that the story will take. Now, predictability isn't inherently a negative attribute, but this is the closest thing I could find to a negative for this movie since it's so good. Luca was a nice break compared to the usual stuff I watch. A kid-friendly feel-good movie that seems like it would also be enjoyable for adults. It could have a bit more subversion, but that's just me being picky for my taste. I'd give it a solid 9 out of 10. I highly suggest you check this movie out. It's on Disney Plus. You're listening to Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. I'm Mosey Helper, Editor-in-Chief of Manor Inc. Before we go, here's my letter from the editor. The summer is almost over, and school is getting closer and closer by the day. Things were looking pretty good for the past few months, and I think most of us that go to school were preparing to get back into school in person. But with the threat of the COVID-19 Delta variant looming over us, those plans might be dashed. The new Delta strain is not only more contagious than the original, but it can even be passed on by people who are vaccinated. The vaccine is still effective in preventing the dangerous effects of the Delta variant. Even if you're vaccinated, the CDC recommends wearing masks indoors now. So please, everyone, wear your masks, get vaccinated if you can, stay safe. That's all for Radio Chatskill Teen Edition. Special thanks to David Dan, Arch Steinhauer, Diana Fredenberg, Amy Hines, Taylor Jaffick, and everyone involved with Manor Inc. You can find more information about Manor Inc. at manorinc.org. Radio Chatskill Teen Edition is produced in partnership with WJFF Radio Chatskill. I'm Elsie Helper, and thank you for listening.
Hi, Judy Brown.
Hi, Judy. You are familiar with Radio Chatskill. Tell us what you like to listen to.
Last night, I listened to DJ Clive, and I love The Cocktail Show, and I love, is it Pear Radio Hour? She's got an amazing show. Mixtapes. is awesome. I don't know. There's tons of them.
Yeah, you like music.
Yeah, and I like the Rick Steves travel show, too.
Feel the love, share the love, summer of love. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
And that was the audio from Riverfest from our very own Rosie Starr, who happens to join me in the studio here. Hi, Rosie. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
Happy summer fun drive.
Happy summer fun drive. Absolutely.
Rosie was out at Riverfest getting some quotes and some feedback from the community. It was really great to interact with folks, and it was great to hear what they had to say.
Oh, it's so much fun to listen to people, what they have to say about living in the area, what they love about summer, what they love about Radio Catskill. And it was a beautiful, warm day.
Yeah.
The Main Street was a river of people, very civilized and elegant and having fun, and the poster auction, dogs walking up and down, and being there with Tim and other volunteers. It was a great day.
It was a great day, and folks told us how much they love Radio Catskill and gave us the idea of, hey, maybe we should call this the Summer of Love Fun Drive, because people say that, and we love you too. So show the love, share the love, support Radio Catskill during this time, our Summer Fun Drive. Call 845-482-4141, and you can talk to Rosie. She'll take your pledge, or you can go online, wjffradio.org. We just finished up with the Radio Catskill Teen Edition from the Student Journalists of Manor, Inc.
Yes,
they always bring us great content once a month, the beginning of the month, every Saturday, and all of their content is available in the print edition of Manor, Inc., which is out now. They're a great group of kids.
I've enjoyed them in the last few months. It's so refreshing to hear their voices, their perspective. It brings another layer of perspective to the airwaves. I mean, all of the production here has a different age groups, and they certainly add their valued perspective. And your valued perspective is good right now. If you'd like to give us a call at 845-482-4141 and show how much you love this programs and everything that we do it in Radio Catskill here. But you can go online also, wjffradio.org.
Yes, and one of the other things we have from different perspectives is podcasts. We have some podcasts, original podcasts, including Cooking in the Catskills, original Radio Catskill podcast that explores the history and current pulse of the Catskill Mountains through the lens of food, and it's hosted by Chef Brett August. He loves food. He loves the history of food and hospitality in the Catskills as well. So today we have an excerpt of that podcast. I don't know if you've heard Cooking in the Catskills yet, but you might know this chef, Rosie. It's today Chef Brett is talking to the head chef at Calicoon Hills, Chef Jean-Paul Medina, or Chef JP, as some folks know him. So here's an excerpt from Cooking in the Catskill, available at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
I was cooking in the city from 2013. I started off at BLT Fish, BLT Steak, and then just kind of started doing quick stints around the city. I was looking for the upstate experience, but I didn't know that that's what I was looking for up until 2017. I was getting kind of tired of calling in my orders to purveyors that didn't care about me, didn't care about the quality of the food. They were just looking to make a sale. And I kind of yearned for that local relationship that I have now. And so we found it. We got a call from Sims and Justine at Foster Supply Hospitality with the opportunity to open up with the Bruce. And it was exactly what we wanted to do. Everything was local from our farmers. It was foraged from the mountain behind the property. And at the same time, my girlfriend and I were looking to escape the chaos of the city. So, all the needles pointed in the right direction. And we said, all right, let's take this leap. Let's get out of here and let's figure it out. And we started visiting the area to kind of get a feel of what we were going to get ourselves into. And just, it was love at first sight from the house that we found, from the locals in Calicoon that were so welcoming. So such an amazing and supporting group. It was just love at first sight. So we moved up here and then we just started working and cooking, and the honeymoon period isn't over. I'm still in love with the area, with the ingredients, with the opportunities that just come, they come about every day.
Tell me, a lot of people start cooking, young, and with me, it was my mom in the kitchen, Italian background, all that jazz. What about you? I mean, your mom cooking, is it something you grew up doing? How did that happen?
Yeah, same scenario. My mom was one of 11 kids, and so they all obviously had children as well. three or four at least. So the family was huge. And my mom was usually the one that was in the kitchen cooking for the family gatherings, you know, whether it be birthdays or Christmas or New Year's, whatever it was. She was kind of the official, unofficial caterer of it. And the only way she can keep eyes on me was to just have me next to her in the kitchen. And it was, you know, it was a hands-on experience. I mean, aside from, you know, just being home, the love and the attention that my mom gave us is always, it always came from the kitchen. And we were always hanging out with her in the kitchen. So we were always just very involved in the day-to-day meal making for my dad or just for the, you know, the household eating. And then when the events happened, obviously it was full hands on deck. So, you know, as a kid, you just kind of fall, you know, start falling in love with it. And then you consume it. And it's just very interesting to see one product become a byproduct. And then you're ingesting this delicious, full of love meal. And yeah, it's kind of stuck with me. You know, I tried a bunch of different careers and none of them really stuck the way the kitchen did. And, you know, I realized later on in life, I'm like, holy cow, like this is what I should have been doing the whole time. But it was just more of a hobby and more of a passion than I ever considered it a career until I considered it a career. And that's when I went to culinary school. I went to FCI. That didn't last very long, but I, you know, I got out of there and really got all my experience from being in the kitchens.
So are you born in the States or where?
No, I was born in Colombia. I was born in Colombia in South America. And we moved here when I was 3 years old. So I moved here in 88, moved to New York City. And I was raised in Queens and never left until 4 years ago.
Really cool. Are your mom and dad still in Queens?
Yeah, they are. They are in my childhood home.
Couple of things that I really enjoy about you, your demeanor, you know, the soft-spoken, super nice gentleman who's super respectful, you know, because a lot of people are running kitchens and, you know, they're animals. They're, you know, disrespectful, blah, blah, blah. I guess that maybe that was the era that I was cooking, you know, way back in the day where it was, you know, it's a bunch of maniacs running around, but I've been in your kitchen and people are wearing Air Jordans and listening to rap music. I mean, it's just everything that I wish I could possibly be in running a kitchen like you. And so where is this from? Is it your mom's side? Is it your dad's side? Is it both of them? I mean, because you're a crazy cool dude.
It's a little bit of everything, to be honest with you. You know, like the perfect dish, it's all about balancing, right? So luckily, I came into the industry in a moment where it was a little transitional. So some of, you know, you kind of had that half and half. You kind of had those guys that were still animals, that were still, you know, the pots and pan throwers. But the new generation of the cooks that were coming in weren't built that way. You know, they didn't have the mental capacity or the mental strength to deal with that. And to be honest with you, I don't think that is necessary to make good food. I don't think it's necessary to execute at a high level either. You know, I was also in those kitchens where everything was super tight and everything was just very, but it got to a point where that almost became stale, right? And I feel that your emotions, regardless of the quality of the food, your emotional stability or level does reflect on the food. And I think that in order to make delicious food, when you're not the one, you know, when you have line cooks, you are no longer touching everything that's coming out of the window. And in order for it to be to your standard or as perfect as you want it to, you want them to be at 100%. And you want them to be comfortable and you want them to almost feel like they're at home. So without sacrificing too many standards and too much level of execution, you kind of learn to pick your battles, right? Especially now, given the COVID times, good sets of hands are hard to come by. So, you know, music, I don't think music is a bad idea to have in the kitchen. You know, communication is key. And during service, music is off. Everybody is quiet. You know, when we're on, we're on. But during prep time, that's the most essential time. You know, I think that's when I want all my cooks to be feeling like they're at home. So, you know, with music's on, that's okay with me. You know, if you want to wear sneakers that, you know, that are not going to allow you to slip and fall, that's fine. You know, whatever makes you feel comfortable up until service time. Once service time starts, you know, head down, shut up, head down. Nothing but delicious and amazing food. But other than that, you know, I want you to feel at home. I want my guests to feel at home. I want my staff to feel at home. I want everybody to feel at home because that's the one place you're sacrificing in order to be at the restaurant working with me or for me.
Yeah, it really shows. I like walking in your kitchen. I mean, it's kind of like family. I know you're, I don't know if he's your, I call him your right-hand man, your sous chef, but, you know, as you know, I went to high school with his wife and, you know, I know him from,
right.
It's just, you run, people are really, talk to your guys. They're really happy working for you. You lead a really good crew. I wanted to ask you, like, what do you enjoy? I know, you know, it's tough being a chef because, you know, you grew up cooking something this or Colombian this or that. But when you're cooking for people, you have to piece them and do menus according to where you are, the Catskills, the atmosphere, this, that. But what do you enjoy cooking?
I enjoy cooking everything, anything in general. My rule of thumb, you on the way to work and on the way from work, you have your environment. You have what's going on around you, right? So on my way to work, I look out the window. Eyes on the road, but there's also this beautiful environment around me that inspires me the most. It's not just a seasonal thing; it's a daily thing, right? So, what I see outside the window is what I want to put on the plate, or what I want you to see on the plate, so that when you're on your ride home, you're still seeing my dish around what's going on around you, whether it be because of the venison, because of the turkey, because of whatever it is you saw on the plate. I want you to see that on your way home and on your daily ride to wherever you're going. So it's constantly on your mind. It's constantly repetitive, and it's fresh. It's delicious. It's just, it doesn't go away. I love to cook. I hate eating it, but I love cooking seafood, and that's something that's not very available to us here, other than the trout is what's super, super local. But I love cooking seafood. There's something about executing it properly and perfectly, and how fragile it is, that just, it's exciting to have that challenge. And to have to do it, 100 times a night, for all the covers is fun.
Everybody I've interviewed and anybody I've ever spoken to has never understood exactly what you said. And I cannot wait to tell Allison, my wife, I love cooking fish, but I'm not the biggest fish eater. But there's something about fish, and you just summed it up. Isn't it crazy? I love cooking fish, right? Everything about it.
There's something so like intimate about it, right? Like it's challenging. It could be frustrating. It could be, but at that point, when it's time for the seafood to hit the pan, it doesn't matter how in the weeds you are. It doesn't matter how skilled you are. It all stops. Like you have nothing else to focus on but that dish or that protein at that moment, because it requires that much attention. It's just like, it's the one thing that can destroy the night or make the night.
Totally.
You just have to focus on it. And it's intimate. And the intimacy is what I love about it the most. It's just, you just connect it to that one piece.
I want to ask you one more really good question, or what my favorite question to ask is, right now on your menu that's out there, what's your favorite thing?
The wings. It's something that everybody's got on their menu, but I think it's the one item on the menu that we dedicate so much time and so many steps to. We cure them first with salt, sugar, herbs, spices. We let them cure for a little bit, nice and relaxed. We want to bring the temperature of the wings to a safe level and not completely cold, because we want the meat to expand and relax and absorb all these spices and herbs. Then we rinse them off and we confit them for about an hour. So we cook them in fat really low and slow to really break down any fibers, any tissue, anything that just is going to get in the way of you enjoying the wing itself. And then we cool them down. We rapid chill them to have them seize up again and congeal, which will be easier for us to handle them so they don't break apart. And then on the pickup, we dust them in cornmeal and deep fry them so that they get really crispy on the outside. So it'll be super crispy outside, very, very tender, soft on the inside. And then we have two sauces, a maple syrup based and then a spicy honey sauce. We also smoke another set of wings with a dry rub. So there's three choices to pick from. But my favorite ones are definitely the spicy ones. It's honey. It's a chili lime honey sauce. And then we throw a little bit of lavender and micro cilantro on top to kind of just mess around with your palate a little bit. Get a nice aroma and relax. Like it's spicy, but it's warm and like a hug. I don't know. There's something about the aromatics that just kind of like bring it home and take away from just it being spicy, just being sweet. It's a whole experience that we get that we give with our wings. We also serve them whole. Again, everybody does the segments, everybody does the sections, but there's something, I like messy eating. I like, I like your hands on, get it all over your face, you're on a date, but so what, both of you are getting sauces everywhere, like it's about breaking down walls and just making you feel comfortable, making you feel at home. You know what I mean? It should be delicious and saucy and just all over the place. And when it's over, then you get your main course, but you still remember the wings, even when you're having the dessert.
That's an excerpt from Cooking in the Catskills with Chef Brett August. It's available at WJFFradio.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can go to WJFFradio.org and hear that full interview with Chef JP. And it's our Summer of Love Fun Drive. Donate now at 845-482-4141. Show your support, share the love, or go online and donate wjffradio.org. Rosie's here, and Farm and Country is coming up next. You're listening to WJFF Jeffersonville. We are Radio Catskill, your public radio station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Show your support. Donate now at 845-482-4141 or go online, wjffradio.org.
Support for Farm